Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Nevada Barr, whose new thriller is What Rose Forgot. We'll also hear from Matt Sacchichini, co-editor of Remaking New Orleans, Beyond Exceptionalism and Authenticity. It's a real pleasure to speak with Nevada Barr today. Nevada is the best-selling author of the Anna Pigeon series, featuring the park ranger who also solves serious crimes. Today, we're talking about Nevada's new book, What Rose Forgot, which introduces a great new character, Rose Dennis. We're proud to claim Nevada as a part-time New Orleanian, though she lives part of the time in Ashland, Oregon. We forgive you. Nevada Barr, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm glad to be here. And my part-time in Ashland seems to be getting shorter and shorter.
I noticed that.
Yeah, I'm homesick a lot.
Now, you really love putting your women in tough spots. I remember the opening of Rope, which is one of my favorite openings in any book ever, where Anna Pigeon awakes to find herself totally at the bottom of a well, naked, in the dark. I mean, sometimes I think you're writing Naked and Afraid. But this pickle that Rose Dennis finds herself in at the beginning of What Rose Forgot is equally bad. So tell us about that spot.
This book kind of just came upon me after I hadn't written anything for a couple years, and writing had gotten very hard. And this came upon me as just absolute fun. And nobody tends to think of a romp through the Alzheimer's ward as a great deal of fun, but I had such fun writing it because it just brought in a lot of things that I like to write about what is concerning me and what I'm thinking about. And as I've gotten older, this sort of character, and there's a lot of really wonderful and funny things about being in your 60s to your 90s that people, they focus on the dark things instead of the fact that a lot of it's just enormously good fun.
And a lot of it is shucking off expectations.
Yes.
And just doing what you want to do and
yes.
think you should be doing.
In fact, I had a discussion with my agent who just couldn't believe a 68-year-old woman could, you know, we're supposed to just be out on an ice floe, you know, waiting for the bear. And I told him, I tested all of the stunts in this book myself, and it can be done.
Well, I'm in awe. I'm in truly in awe. But Rose starts off in a hospital gown,
mm-hmm.
open in the back,
mm-hmm.
in the woods, not remembering anything, who she is, where she came from, anything. That must have been really terrifying to imagine. That's everybody's nightmare.
It is everybody's nightmare. Then you add to that, people really are out to get you.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with that. And she's confused because of the situation she's in with the drugs and the confusion and so forth. It's also a writer's nightmare because you have to find the confusion and the humor and the fear with a protagonist who can't clearly narrate it for you because they're learning as you go. And one thing that bores the stuffings out of me are long dream sequences. And I just didn't want this to have that feeling of a long dream sequence. So her finding her bearings in this sea of confusion was quite a challenge.
And first she thinks that someone is in the memory care facility is out to get her.
Yes.
And then this conspiracy grows a little larger, doesn't it?
Yes. She has to find her way out of the memory care facility and out from under the drug haze that they've put her in. And then she finds out, well, they're still out to get her.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
How do you survive life on the lam as a 68-year-old?
Exactly.
I mean, but she does make this great escape, and she does find momentary shelter, and she does set out to solve this case, which is pressingly important. And she does it with the help of a very spunky young woman.
That was so much fun. I love children 13 to 17. They're just powerhouses, and they're learning so much stuff. And so to give her a granddaughter of 13 and then the granddaughter's friend to play with, it's almost as good as having a cat in your book or a dog.
A talking cat or dog.
To help the plot and help the protagonist express herself and be seen by someone else and interact with someone. And interacting with a young teenager is another terrifying thing.
Yeah, always. You never know. But the relationship between them is so strong and mutually supportive. It's just fun to see the way they play off each other. Teenager's addiction to the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says to Rose, I wish you'd keep forgetting that you smoked cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But no, she remembers
that.
So they have a wonderful conversation where Mel attempts to fill in the gaps and rationalize what has happened to Rose ending up in the memory care unit. So I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Let's see. This is Mel. You know, Gigi, it's not like you were really completely normal, Melanie says miserably. You've always been, well, you know, kind of eccentric. I am not in the least eccentric, Rose declares. The tide of anger, though generic, is still buoying her up. Eccentric? What a crock! You meditate, Melanie says defensively. Oh, for heaven's sake, Rose explodes. Everybody meditates. Meditation is the new Prozac. You're always standing on your head everywhere, Melanie continues doggedly. That's yoga. Yoga is not eccentric. Yoga is so mainstream. Studios have mommy and me classes. You're a painter and a poet. A lucrative painter, very lucrative, Rose says, holding up a finger. And a published poet, thank you very much. That is not eccentric. That's downright miraculous. Rose is listening to her own voice as if it were that of the oracle at Delphi. The words are true. A verbal form of automatic writing. They bespeak her memories, the facts that make up her self. She is coalescing out of the fog, taking on form. Stella said you smoke marijuana, Mel says. Rose throws up her hands. They smack into the ceiling. It's medicinal, she shouts. Her own noise scares her. She squirms around until she can look out of the window. Her racket has not alarmed the main house. The porch light does not go on. The screen door is not thrown open. You wear African pants with the crotch at your knees and carry a parasol with purple sequins on it, Mel rushes on. Nobody in New Orleans thinks I'm eccentric, Rose counters. Melanie rolls her eyes. I wouldn't use that defense in crazy court. Crazy court. Rose thinks about that. A few hardy crickets sing. Candlelight flickers. The incomparable peace of familiarity and love settles into the playhouse. Rose's eyes grow heavy. Almost she can believe that Harley is alive, and she has never been lost, confused, and incarcerated. I'm from New Orleans, she says. She is from New Orleans.
I love that. And it grounds her and gives her herself back.
Yes.
Which I love.
Yes.
So thank you for that. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Nevada Barr, whose new book is What Rose Forgot. We'll be right back.
And now that the past is gone, fell upon my shoes and sullied the shine of what once was mine.
And so what we learn is that Rose is from New Orleans. She's recently moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where this book takes place, lost her husband. Her whole world has been turned upside down.
Yes, and all of her support systems and friends are not only older people who she does might have health issues, people she doesn't want to disturb, but she doesn't have any support system in the new city, which is part of this was I had moved to Ashland for the summers here, and it is very hard changing cities now.
Yeah.
I used to change cities all the time. But once you've lived in New Orleans, changing is harder. It ain't New Orleans, wherever you're at.
I think that's good to hear in some ways. So as Rose sets out to do this, the thing I love about her is that she's 68. She's not afraid of physical exertion. She's not afraid to fight. She dodges. She fights back. She thinks hard. She outthinks all her adversaries, which I love. She is quick as she regains her memories.
It's one of the things I had with Anna, and of course, Anna was younger and trained and stronger, mm-hmm. etc., but I like mysteries or thrillers where it is literally one person outthinking the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the great conspiracies and cell phones and interactions. In fact, my sister did the computer aspect of this as Rose's sister. And we made sure that everything she did on the computer, we could actually do if we had to. We could figure
wow.
it out. Because otherwise, the computer is used as deus ex machina too much in books. You know, you just, mm-hmm. you secretly find out the password in 20 seconds and then save the world. And I thought, now this has got to be computer stuff that a real person might could pull off.
I know, and it sounds possible.
Yeah.
It does sound possible. And I especially love her sister, Marion.
Yes.
Whose great refrain is, I am not a hacker.
Yeah. I just explore.
We know you're a hacker, Marion. So I think it must have been so much fun to be in Rose's head for this book. So will she be back, I hope?
I've started a second one. I've got the first chapter written, and it's the first chapter's just laying there daring me to write a second one. So it may happen. It'll wait and see, because I'm not done playing with her yet.
Oh.
I have such fun with her, and I like her people.
I do, too. And I like her sassy style and her refusal to go gently anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, or to go loudly everywhere.
Yes.
Although I would like to see more of the cute Uber driver, Brian.
Yeah, he was based on a local guy who shall remain anonymous except for the fact his name is Harry and he's my husband's backgammon partner. So Harry got a cameo as the Uber driver.
Oh, I thought that was super. Well, Nevada, thank you for giving hope to baby boomers everywhere. Mm. If you wake up in a fog, perhaps you can find your way out.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, we've been talking with Nevada Barr, whose terrific new novel is What Rose Forgot. You can meet her Tuesday, September 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Nevada, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been wonderful.
Matt Sacchettini is Associate Professor of Music at Tulane University and the author of Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans. I love that book.
Thank you.
Today we're talking about a new book Matt has co-edited with Thomas Jessen Adams of the University of Sydney. The book is called Remaking New Orleans Beyond Exceptionalism and Authenticity. So Matt Sacchettini, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me. I love being here, Susan.
Oh, fun for me too. Now, this book grew out of a conference held at Tulane in 2014. So tell us about that conference and what inspired it and what its purpose was and who put it together.
Well, like a lot of us who live here, we were looking ahead to the tricentennial and thinking about 300 years of New Orleans. We didn't know, of course, at the time that great historians like Jason Berry and others would be publishing histories of New Orleans. But that's okay because we were interested in something a little bit different. We wanted to relate the history, the past of New Orleans that so many of us are enchanted with the present. And so we invited not only historians, but also anthropologists, literary scholars, media experts, political scientists, people based here in Louisiana, based all around the country to kind of give them a provocation. We wanted to address the penchant to isolate New Orleans as a world apart from everywhere else, and not just to take what we call exceptionalism, that New Orleans is an exceptional place, not just take that as a given. So that conference, like you said, was back in 2014. It took a little while to get everybody together and get the book edited. There's 20 authors in the book, incredible contemporary scholars, an introduction by myself and Thomas Adams. As you mentioned, he's moved to Sydney, Australia, and become the director of the U.S. Studies Center since that time. And the introduction's also co-written by Sue Mobley, who went on to co-found Paper Monuments and work in community design here in the city.
That's exciting. That's exciting. New Orleans is a city that's always in conversation with itself, always debating, celebrating its nature. And this book examines a lot of the existing strands in that conversation, as well as adding some new ones. And that was the goal, right?
That was the goal. I think it's interesting. The three of us who wrote the introduction, we all moved to New Orleans in the 1990s. And one of the things that hits you when you come here is how strongly rooted people are to this place. There's such a strong identity and sense of place here. I'm from Worcester, Massachusetts, originally. I don't think there's a strong sense of pride, right, that we associate with this place. And we've all felt that very deeply, all of the contributors to this book. The city is so unique in countless ways. But we wanted to sort of take on the idea that New Orleans is unlike anywhere else only, that first of all, New Orleans has been an American city for over 200 years. It may be kind of lopping along towards that. It might be incomplete, but certainly we share a lot of issues with other American cities. And in that way, we're also not incomparable. We have a lot here that does relate, for example, to other port cities in the Caribbean and Latin America or in the United States, socially to other places where racism, where sexism, where inequality are really entrenched, and politically to, say, liberal cities in more conservative states, and basically wanted to try to rebalance the sense of self that we have as New Orleanians and not just focus on the cultural ways that make us different from other places.
Now, in the second section of the book, it's called Producing the Authentic City. There's a fascinating essay by LSU professor Helen Regis called Local Native Creole Black, Claiming Belonging, Producing Autochthony. And that raises some issues that are familiar to all New Orleanians. You know, that question, are you from here? Where'd you go to high school? We claim identity and so proudly and oddly at the same time, you know?
True. I remember when I moved to New Orleans back in the 90s, I had been working in Washington, D.C. previously, and I was really in Washington struck by the idea that people identify themselves around the kind of work they do for the most part. You know,
right.
Do you work in government? Are you a lawyer? I come to New Orleans, and once people get to know me, they say, where'd you go to high school, right? It's a way of placing yourself within this really complicated matrix of identities of what it means to be in New Orleans, who belongs here, who has the ability to claim a kind of pride of place, right? And Helen's chapter, as you mentioned, she's an anthropologist at LSU, but she's also lived in New Orleans and a graduate of Tulane. And she's basically trying to take at face value this obsession with belonging. She's very interested around the definitions of native versus local, which for someone outside of New Orleans, it's like, well, what does that even mean? Well, of course, if you're from here and you're born here, then you're a native, and that's a special pride of place. If you've moved to New Orleans and chosen to stay here, well, maybe you might attain some kind of local status. You know, me as a parent of a kid who's raised in New Orleans, maybe I'm now considered a local, maybe she's considered a native. It's kind of subjective, right? She points out that Katrina is one kind of boundary line. For a lot of people who were here before Katrina, even if you weren't born in New Orleans, natives grant you some type of local status. And if you arrived in the city after Katrina, maybe you don't get that special status unless you've earned some other type of rootedness here.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Matt Sacchichini, co-editor of Remaking New Orleans, Beyond Exceptionalism and Authenticity. Talk a little bit about Felipe Smith's essay, Things You'd Imagine Zulu Tribes to Do, the Zulu Parade and New Orleans Carnival. I love that essay.
Me too. Felipe was actually one of my professors way back when I decided to go back to grad school. He's an English professor at Tulane now retired. He's a native New Orleanian,
yes.
related to our previous discussion, and identifies as African American. And he's kind of grappling from that position with New Orleans' identification as the most Africanized city in the United States. And he's focusing specifically on the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club, which on the one hand is the city's really only official Mardi Gras crew that started as a black organization, and talking around about some of the ambivalence around that, because Zulu is also rooted in satire of blackface, of stereotypes of not only African Americans, but continental Africans. This book does not shy away from issues that are very controversial, right? Zulu is not free from controversy. There's a burden placed on Zulu for not only representing place, like all Mardi Gras crews do, but also representing race, because Zulu chooses to continue to adopt blackface, to dress in skirts and kind of a mirror some ugly stereotypes of African Americans, literally back in the 1800s, as an inferior species, right?
Right.
There were white Mardi Gras crews like Comus who had entire parades dedicated to this idea that was called social Darwinism, that there was a hierarchy of races and that Africans and African Americans were at the bottom. This goes into some deep, dark places of American history, but it also goes up into more recent times when those ideas become controversial.
So what was the single most provocative thing that has informed your work since this conference? What did it do for your life as a scholar and thinker about the city?
That's a great question. I think, well, first I just want to say that this is a book of chapters written by some amazing people. It's not
Absolutely.
A book you have to read cover to cover. If you're interested in certain aspects, if you're interested in a history of sort of LGBTQ New Orleans in the mid-century, you can skip ahead to Alicia Long's chapter and read about the French Quarter in
that the 1950s. That was so much fun. That's the most fun chapter, I think.
If you're interested in, you know, the history of Latinos in New Orleans, you can start with, you know, Shannon Doughty's amazing chapter
yes.
about Mexicans in our colonial past.
Yeah.
I think listening to these scholars and experiencing this place and putting this book together with Thomas and many others has led me to ask, to kind of go, as I go around the city, ask, what about Poydras Street? What about New Orleans East? What about Pontchartrain Park, a middle-class black suburban enclave? What do these places tell us about New Orleans in relationship to America? We have to ask ourselves, even if we are going to talk about the French Quarter or the Treme, does the way the French Quarter is historicized or the way Treme is marketed really match up with the reality of what those places are like in 2019? The French Quarter caters pretty much exclusively to visitors. I'm not saying there's not residents there. There's very powerful residents there, but it's curated to be an experience for outsiders. The Treme is now much more of an architectural preservation neighborhood than an active hub of black cultural traditions that it had been for centuries. So we're asking what it means to factor in the whole of New Orleans from top to bottom and not only focus on those cultural ways that make us different. And I think if to the spirit of your question, you know, I go about asking myself, am I a local? You know, what is New Orleansness? What is Americanness? And, you know, I say, sure I am. But that can be taken away from me by anyone at any moment.
I've only lived here half my life.
But
it's like everybody says, you know, I may not be from New Orleans, but I got there as soon as I could. You know, that's
Absolutely.
What we can all say.
Yeah, I joke of my hometown, and I'm sorry, but I made it out.
Well, it's such a book full of questions, not easy answers, but full of great questions. So it's a lot of fun to read. And you're right, dip in and out at your leisure, and you'll learn something new. We've been talking with Matt Sacchettini of Tulane University, who's the co-editor of Remaking New Orleans Beyond Exceptionalism and Authenticity. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Susan. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, the big event this week is Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner, which runs September 24th through 26th at the Cabildo and the Hotel Peter and Paul. The theme for 2019 is the American experience in literature and life, including a talk by Faulkner biographer Jay Perini. The big read author for this event is Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage, who will appear in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow. The featured Faulkner title is The Wild Palms. For ticket information and complete schedule, go to faulknersociety.org. Jose Torres-Tama discusses in Signs Encuentro, Latinx performance for the New American Theater, at the Faulkner Society's Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner event, Tuesday, September 24th at 1 at the Cabildo. Nevada Barr discusses in Signs What Rose Forgot, Tuesday, September 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Co-editors Matt Sacchini and Thomas Jessen Adams, along with contributors Adrian Dixon, Juliet Mobley, Brian Wagner, Cedric Johnson, and Ryan Fertel, celebrate the release of their new collection, Remaking New Orleans, Beyond Exceptionalism and Authenticity, Tuesday, September 24th from 6 to 8, upstairs at Mimi's in the Marigny, 2601 Royal Street. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their general meeting Wednesday, September 25th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The guest speaker is Kevin Gardair, Executive Director of Bridge House Grace House, discussing There Is a Solution. You can also sign up to volunteer for the big book sale coming up October 10th through 13th at the Pontchartrain Center. Trenton Lee Stewart discusses in Signs the Mysterious Benedict Society and the Riddle of Ages, Wednesday, September 25th at 4 at Octavia Books. Letters Read, curated by Nancy Sharon Collins, presents a reading of the letters of the Baroness Pontalba, Wednesday, September 25th at 5:30 at the State Museum, 701 Charters. Carolyn Cobb, local historian, continues her series titled The History of Jefferson Parish with Part 3, Kenner, Gretna, Crevasses, Agriculture, the WPA, World War II. That's Wednesday, September 25th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Bruce Sunpie Barnes and Rachel Brenlin debut a new book CD from the Neighborhood Story Project, Le Coeur Creole, The Creole Heart. Thursday, September 26th at 6:30 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, 400 Esplanade Avenue. Johnette Downing signs her newest book, Spooky Second Line, Saturday, September 28th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The September meeting of the Jane Austen Society North America, Louisiana region will be a discussion of Rebecca, a modern Gothic novel. It will be held on Saturday, September 28th at 2 at Lambeth House, 150 Broadway in New Orleans. Off-street parking is available for visitors. Max Brawlier discusses in Signs The Last Kids on Earth and The Midnight Blade, Sunday, September 29th at 11 at Octavia Books. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.